Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for attending this morning. We're delighted to be joined by Damien Gammell, CEO of Coca-Cola Euro-Pacific Partners. Today we have about 40 minutes. We'll have some time for Q&A at the end. So if you'd like to submit any questions, I think there'll be some instructions. Hopefully by now you're familiar with the process. Without further ado, let's jump into it. If you're okay, Damien?
Yeah. Yep. Thanks, man.
Brilliant. So my first question, and I suppose quite a timely one, on your recent capital markets event in Manila. There you gave a lot of information, but you commented on your ambition to deliver midterm growth of 4% and more. Can you walk us through what you expect to be the main drivers of that growth and will drive you ahead of that 4% level over the coming years?
Yeah, so I think it was... It was a great opportunity, I think, after we, you know, bought the Philippines business to just kind of step back and share with a wider audience how we're thinking about the business over the next 3, 5 and more years. And a key pillar of that was our guidance. And that starts with the 4 on revenue, 7 on operating profit, and then that cash flow number around 1.7 to 1.8 billion. So we feel really good about it. Clearly, the key driver of our business and our passion is top-line growth. So that 4 is really where we're putting most of our effort. And, you know, I'd be very happy with a consistent 4, if I'm being honest. I think in today's world, top-line growth is the quality metric for any organization. So that's really where we're spending most of our time with the Coca-Cola company. This week goes with Monster. Reviewing, you know, our NPD pipeline for the next 2 years, tasting the products. So break down the 4, you know, clearly we benefit from some markets, and I'm talking midterm, so like Indonesia and Philippines, good macros, good GDP growth, and we'd expect those to grow kind of mid to high single digits consistently in revenue. Our Australian, New Zealand, and markets that we don't talk a lot about, but we're starting to because they're getting material, like PNG and the islands, you know, they're a couple of basis points less. And again, that's really driven by GDP, demographics, per capitas. And then, you know, where we are most challenged with top-line growth is obviously Western Europe. And there we've been kind of at around 2 to 3% growth revenue. Pricing is quite good, so pricing will be an element of growth. We continue to take price, and that's, you know, on an average, it's probably a couple of points. We get good mix. We're seeing that actually get a little bit better this year as our outer retail business away from home starts to perform, so that's driving growth. But clearly the magic element on that's going to be volume. You know, so what we're really working hard on is having volume, particularly, well, it'll come in the other markets, but particularly in Europe. You know, we'd love to get to a point where a third of our growth was volume, a third was price, and a third was mix. I think this year we're definitely seeing price mix. We're starting to see volume come through and away from home. So that's the algorithm. What will kind of sit below that? I'll start with the highest growth area, energy. So, you know, energy has come back really strong this year. Last year was a little bit weaker, but a little bit weaker was like high single digits, so not so weak relative in FMCG. You know, this year, if you look at our Q1 results, it's getting back closer to that mid-teens to 20% growth. So that's going to be a consistent driver. As I said, the innovation pipeline is amazing. The category per caps are still relatively low in Europe. And it's very competitive, which drives the category. So we've got great competition. I think the next big driver, obviously, will be our core brands. So, you know, obviously, Coke Zero's had a great run, growing volume, growing share. I called out two brands that are really big. Obviously, our biggest brand, Coke Classic. We're bringing back more innovation on that brand. So if you look at our historic kind of plans, a lot of our innovation went on Zero, quite rightly, as we see kind of the no sugar category being the fastest growing category in soft drinks. But we're bringing some of that innovation back on the Classic. So more flavors. We've been good on pack innovation, but not on product innovation. And then a big brand for us is Diet Coke. So Diet Coke is still, you know, our largest sugar-free brand in GB. despite the growth of zero. And we feel that that's a brand that just needs a bit more attention. So that'll drive Fanta, Sprite, continue to grow volume. We're excited about the sports category. Australia's really kind of opened their eyes again to the size of that category. If you go to Australia or New Zealand, you'll just see, you know, sports being a much more mainstream category. In Europe, we haven't quite got there yet. Germany's probably our best market for Powerade, but we want to replicate that. We see that ahead of us. And then tea continues to be a great category for us with Fuze. We've just moved out of Nestlé in Spain back into Fuze. So kind of growth will come across those from a brand perspective. It'll come from away from home as we see that slowly recovering. That's kind of quick tour of our four.
That's brilliant. And picking up on a couple of the points you mentioned, I suppose, you know, thinking about volume growth in Europe being a main, you know, one of the main issues and one of the main areas you want to address over the midterm. Clearly, trademark Coke is very important in that. Yeah. You know, you've got the Share a Coke campaign this summer. Quite a few. There we go. Great product placement. You know, you're doing a lot around the brand, but you know, could you just kind of talk through, I suppose, this year, you know, what do you expect to be the uplift from that campaign? And I suppose over the midterm, you know, what else, what other levers can you pull to really kind of, you know, re-energize the trademark Coke brand?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's a number of tools that we're looking at. So Share a Coke, it was 8 years since we did that campaign. And it's really landed well. Early days to talk about, you know, what it's going to do numerically. But in terms of brand, you know, I would say excitement, innovation, connectivity to our consumers, it's a fantastic campaign. So from an execution perspective, which I can talk to because I've, you know, been in the market and I've seen our numbers internally, execution's bang on track. So I'm really happy with that. And we're hearing a lot that it's generating the excitement we wanted. I think beyond that, we've made some, I think, good and bold moves. We've just signed the EPL in GB to a 3-year deal led by Coke trademark. I mean, those of us who live in the UK who are unfortunate enough to follow a team like Chelsea, you know how passionate an asset that can be in that market. But even beyond that, I mean, I think in our markets, maybe not so much in Europe, but certainly in Asia Pac, the Premier League is a great asset. So that's something we didn't have before. So we're really going to leverage that. And then obviously I talked about flavor innovation. So if you look at the growth within sparkling soft drinks, even on colas, a lot of it comes from flavor. So we know that brings people into the brand. It gives them a different choice. And we just haven't really been good at that in classic Coke. So that's going to come back. And then we're also looking at pack pricing. So I think as we think about volume, we've got to continue to kind of look at, you know, price points and magic price points. And we do a lot of work on analytics and trying to understand what happens at what price point for us and our competitor. And I suppose a good example of something that's new coming to our business is we've just launched an 850 ml PET pack in Germany. And our traditional pack around that space was 1 liter. And as we've seen cost inflation and COGS inflation, clearly our pricing has gone up consistently year on year. So we're definitely trying to innovate on packaging as well, just to see if we can get to a point where we unlock another level of consumer access to the brand. So a lot happening. And then obviously, you know, we're looking to a number of assets. We've got Star Wars coming. So plenty of tools, and that's what we're focused on.
Yeah, great. And then I suppose focusing on the other key category, to my mind, is energy, as you mentioned. You know, you said that 2024 is a relatively slow year for the category, albeit still pretty strong. But we've seen a recovery in Q1 and trends are doing well. You know, how much, I suppose, growth potential do you see for the category? How big can it get within the portfolio, both in Europe, but I suppose more interestingly in APS, where, you know, the category is, I suppose, more nascent in many of your markets?
Yeah. So I suppose the analogy I gave, I think, in Manila as well, was if you were walking a supermarket in Europe maybe 10 years ago, and you walk down the beverage aisle, you'd definitely obviously see, you know, core soft drinks. Then you'd probably see juice, and then you'd see water. And then you'd kind of have a bay full of like other stuff that was trying to break through. Now, when you walk down a beverage aisle, and particularly in terms of revenue, you'll see obviously soft drinks still by far the biggest growing profitable. And then the next category is energy. So it's really grown into being a mainstream beverage occasion. It's very balanced in terms of its consumer profile, both in terms of, you know, male, female. People have an assumption it's a very male-dominated category. It's not. It's depending on the market, it's 60-40, 45-55. They tend to think it's all about teenagers. It's not the average age of the consumer. Again, depending on markets, around 30 years of age. And it's everyday occasion, right? So you'll see people consuming energy in the morning for their caffeine instead of maybe a coffee, and they'll go through the day. And I think what Monster have done brilliantly is they've gone from a very core energy-driven platform with green that had a very distinctive taste that, candidly, a lot of people, either you loved it or, you know, it was a bit like Marmite. And now they've brought in products, obviously sugar-free, but juiced. And the taste profiles are just really good. And competitors are doing something similar. So why I call that out is it obviously broadens the appeal of the category, and that unlocks that long-term growth model. So I think if the category had remained as a kind of nightclub mixer with vodka, where it kind of maybe started many, many moons ago, it would stay very niche. I think what the category has done is broadened its appeal on taste. So in terms of what does that mean? I mean, we've doubled our business in 4 years. You know, I see the category sustainably growing in that, you know, double digit to mid-teens. It's growing higher at the moment, and that could be again for next year. But obviously, as you grow, your base gets bigger. But based on the innovation and the product delivery, I think, and the competition. So the other interesting thing about energy is, there's a lot of big brands spending a lot of money in the category. You know, and that's from F1 to, you know, obviously digital TV. So that's driving growth. And then for us, as we look at Asia Pacific, very hyper cap, relatively hyper caps, I would say, in New Zealand. Australia, very competitive with V, you know, local brand, a really strong brand. So that, again, that category is bigger. And I think part of that's been on the back of having three competitors fighting it out. And we've just launched Monster in Bali. So we said we'd start where we know the number of tourists we get there is huge, particularly from Australia. So they're energy drinkers. So we've launched Monster in Bali. We'll see how that goes. And we've launched Predator in the Philippines and Monster, but mainly a Predator-led, which is a more affordable PET platform. And again, we'll probably bring that to Indonesia. So the category is there, but it's very small. But the need states and the consumer profile, I think the barrier to the category will be price. And that's why we've gone with a Predator platform. And I think that we can kind of build the category that way. So in those markets, you know, it's many years behind Europe and Australia and New Zealand. So it will be part of our growth, but very small at the moment.
On, I suppose, consumer sensitivity to price, you know, it's a topic across the business you've been talking about for years now, but I suppose most acutely in Europe. You've mentioned a lot of the progress you've made in the retail channel over the last year, 2 years, around pack optimization, improving the balance of profitability between the home and away from home channels. You know, how much more runway do you think there is for you to improve the business in the home channel, in particular in Europe, over the coming years? And obviously, doesn't look like the consumer pressure is going away. So, you know, I suppose much of the work you've done already has positioned you well. But I'd be interested to know, you know, where you see, you know, future growth and improvements in that channel.
Yeah, I mean, we've had, you know, a great run in retail. We've expanded margins for our retailers, which is critical. You know, they turn our products very quickly. So when they buy a Coke off us, they kind of sell it 7 or 8 times. So from a cash perspective, it's great for them. So I think the platform we've created for kind of a mutual growth agenda has been there for a number of years now. And that, I think, sets us up for more growth. I talked to the 850 in Germany. I think that's an example of where we're going to have to work smarter and continue to try and bring to the consumer price points and products that are more accessible. From a margin perspective, I feel good about those initiatives because I think the structure that we've got now works. I think it's also a category story. So I think on light, no sugar colas, a lot of innovation, pack innovation, mini cans, same on classic, but not the flavors, as I talked to earlier. And then you go to the second biggest category, which is really, you know, flavored soft drinks. Very, very big. Brands, relatively lower share there. And I would say we need to do the same level of pack innovation in flavors than we've done in on our Coca-Cola business. So that's definitely open to us. So the mini can idea, we're doing a lot of good work on Fanta as well, pack differentiation. So really kind of taking that playbook. You know, we obviously started where it made the biggest difference, which was on light colas, and bringing that into our flavor portfolio. And I think that that opens up, you know, some of that growth in that space as well.
And I suppose you mentioned kind of digital technology, both just now, but also at the CMD, and you went into quite a lot of detail, which is very interesting. I suppose, you know, how does digital, the digital capabilities you have now versus 5 years ago, help you go after those opportunities? I suppose both in terms of the cost side, but also perhaps more interestingly on the top line.
Yeah, maybe I'll start with the cost piece because you know, we've committed to that 350 to 400 million productivity delivery, which is actually probably ahead of plan. So it's great. A key unlocker of that productivity is technology. So if you're working within CCEP, you've just got a very different work environment around tech than you had 4 or 5 years ago. And we've really focused on capabilities and then the tools that deliver the capability. I think it's critically important to start with the capability you're trying to deliver. And then your tech people will find the tools, or they'll build them, right? Or they'll pay very expensive consultants to build them. It's easy to get stuff built. I think what you've got to be crystal clear on is what is the capability you want to unlock? Because, you know, certainly you get inundated with just everybody wanting to move in this space inside an organization. And you've got to be very choiceful about what capabilities you want to move first, because they make the biggest difference to your business. So we've been very choiceful, and that's unlocking that 350 to 400 million. And that's like automated forecasting. It's automated vehicles, it's high bay warehouses. So a lot of very sophisticated technology that takes out a lot of cost. And in Europe, that's absolutely critical, given, you know, the cost of doing business here is just high. You know, whether it's energy prices, whether it's labor, whether it's absenteeism, it's just a more challenging cost environment. So we're really happy with tech in that space. And we demonstrated some of those tools and capabilities when we were in Manila. I think beyond that, we focused on the top line. So our myccep.com platform, which is our B2B platform, we're doing about 2.4 billion of revenue. So it's a lot of cash going through that platform. Gives us a lot of access to information, obviously. But ultimately, it makes it easier to do business with. And I think that's the key of that platform, that if you're a customer of ours, whether you want invoice, whether you want to look at a cooler, whether you want to chat to someone about a marketing campaign, whether you want to download your tax invoice, whether you want to get a view of new product innovation that's available, it's all in the same space. So we prioritize that. And then we've got a front-end tool, which is called RED, which is around right execution daily. And that's really for our field sales team. So again, as you'd expect, a really good sales tool. The next big step is, you know, S/4HANA. So as you all know, we've kind of created CCEP through, you know, a number of acquisitions, which is great. But what you end up with is a disparate set of systems in the back end. So we will go live in Germany this year with S/4HANA. And then we will obviously, based on that, we'll roll it out across the group. That's important because as we think about the next 350 to 400 million, it will come in that space, because as you can imagine, the cost of us running, at the moment we're running 5 separate SAP platforms, and that just drives a lot of complexity and in some ways limits some of our productivity initiatives. So we've been building that over a number of years. That has resulted, as you know, we took our CapEx up from 4% of net revenue to 5%. A lot of that delta was getting ready for SAP in the Philippines. That'll come down again, because obviously, thankfully, you only do an S/4HANA transition once. And that's probably the next big bit of tech change that we'll have at CCP. But we prioritize revenue productivity over the last 5 years. And then, you know, we were looking at what other companies were doing S/4HANA, and then we'll move to S/4HANA now. So that's kind of been the journey.
Brilliant. Shifting a little bit to the Philippines, which is another topic. Obviously, you went into in quite a bit of detail at the capital markets event. One interesting slide that you presented was, I suppose, the margin potential that you saw in that business. You know, the ambition to kind of get that domestic margin to 10%, and then perhaps beyond. When you think about the ambition, I suppose, firstly, you know, do you have a timeline in mind to reach that 10%? And then I suppose beyond that, you know, do you think you have sufficient levers in the Philippines business to kind of get that to group margin and even beyond? You know, where do you see the kind of the long-term profitability of that market?
I definitely have a timeline. I've communicated that to Gareth, our CEO, but we haven't told anybody else. So we are making great progress. So when we bought the business, I think we're about a 6.5. And clearly, you know, emerging markets and high volume growth markets are fantastic. But you can't make the mistake of saying I'll fix margin later, because it's very difficult if you've built business on a low margin to fix it later. Because what happens is when you go and try and fix it, it'll come at the cost of volume or revenue or upsetting a customer, and then it's like, well, we can't do it this year because, you know, it's a tough year and we got to hit the 4. And so we've been very choiceful about saying we want to get margin at least to double digit as quickly as possible in the Philippines, and then we have a path to at least to our group average. Because when we look at CCP in 5 years, you know, Philippines will be, it's material today, it's going to be more material in the future when you look at its growth rate. So I think for the future, it's better to deal with the margin in the near term. And when we look at that, you know, clearly we see a number of areas that we can unlock margin on. First one is supply chain. So, you know, we've spent more capital than they had been spending. And for whatever reasons, the previous owners made that choice. But clearly we looked when we did the due diligence that just the supply chain had been underinvested in. Product was very tight. They were, my first market visit there, they were operating on 2 days inventory on glass. So that was impacting sales. It was stressing out the sales force. So we've put in a number of new lines. We're building a greenfield, which will be state-of-the-art globally in terms of a bottling facility. And that's allowing us to kind of drive cost out of the business and obviously expand margin. We're then also looking at shared services. So we've got a great shared services facility in Bulgaria that has allowed us to move high-cost work out of Europe to there and get productivity and better decision-making. We've just opened one in Manila. So we've about 200 colleagues now in Manila in shared services. So again, we're taking the technology that we've built here, bringing it there, and that's going to unlock more margin as well. And then clearly on the revenue side, we've taken a bit more pricing. And then we're launching categories that are margin accretive. So I talked about energy earlier. We're also getting into alcohol ready to drink, higher margin as well. Cash margin's great. So there's a number of different, you know, aspects across the P&L. And then we're growing volume, you know, in that mid to high single digit. And that's giving us a lot of leverage on the P&L. So a combination of all of that gets us to double digit and sets us on our way to group average.
Brilliant. And then saying in the same neck of the woods, Indonesia, it's had a fairly tumultuous few years, you know, some of it self-inflicted and making, you know, SKU rationalization, all the rest of it. But much of it has been, you know, been macro and the rest of it. So I suppose you know, how do you think about that business? How happy are you with the portfolio? And do you think there's still more work to do in terms of the price pack architecture, the portfolio there? Or are you kind of happy now and just waiting for, I suppose, macro to start to improve?
It's hard to be happy. when you look at our performance there, and there's many macro reasons, but clearly you got to manage within the environment you're in. And I think we've got many things right, but clearly we haven't got everything right. So I suppose starting at, you know, being an optimist, every time I visit there, the size of the country, the population, the weather, the age profile, you just go, this is like a dream market for a beverage company like us. So that's never changed. I think what we've done well is we're a much fitter, more efficient and effective organization now. So we've changed our route to market. We've made changes in our supply network that was completely inefficient. We've engaged with a distributor model, which is what we have in the Philippines. And I've worked with that in Pakistan and in Turkey. It's a far more empowering, performance-driven route to market than our previous one, which was more of a subsidized route to market. So there wasn't really an incentive for your partners to drive volume. They were kind of guaranteed a margin. So I'm really happy with that. We've done great work on local talent. We've got a School of Indonesia in our organization. So if you look at our leadership team now, it's predominantly Indonesian. So I'm really happy with that. So that aspect, I think, has worked well. The first part of that story is important because the second part of the story has got to come, which is, given the macroeconomic issues in Indonesia. So if you look at the country's just under a lot of pressure from a consumer spending perspective across every category. We probably have to change our pack price architecture again. And that's the work we're doing now. And to do that, we need to be super efficient because clearly we want to protect our bottom line. So the first part of our story about productivity and efficiency is going to allow us to get to the next part, which is probably drive affordability even harder. And that's something we're looking at in basically the second half of this year. So that will, we believe will unlock a bit more accessibility to our brands. So from a portfolio perspective, some highlights. We launched Zeros. It's now 30% of our mix in modern trade. That's been a really positive surprise. We changed our large PET pack from 1.5 litre to 1 litre. That's growing mid-teens. Another positive surprise. So people are consuming that more at home. What's not working is our tea platform. And that's still work in progress, to be honest. We haven't quite cracked the tea proposition. So really happy on sparkling, happy that we're launching energy, albeit small, but it's good to get in early, more work to do in tea. So I suppose when you kind of look at the work ahead of us, it's much narrower than it was 4 years ago, where we were looking at route to market, our production sites, our culture, our capability, our technology platform, our key account capability. So we started like that. We've kind of worked our way through that. The most important piece is now, which is that affordability on sparkling. And in some ways, we couldn't afford to think about that because we needed to get the efficiency. And when that happened, obviously, the macros changed as well, right? So it was a bit of a headwind. But I think if I look long term and I think about, sustaining that for growth, sometimes it's good that not everything's working at the same time, because like business, something happens in a big company, you have 31 markets. It's going to be very unusual that every year those 31 markets are just like all on fire. So that, I think Indonesia will turn at a good time for the group and will support that for probably more in the midterm. But it's stabilized this year, which is good for the team locally.
And I suppose, for me, one market, within the APS region or one area, Philippines gets a lot of focus, Indonesia, Australia, but the Pacific and the PNG businesses, which you touched on, again at the CMD, very profitable well-performing businesses, which I think are probably overlooked a lot of the time. How do you think about the potential there? Clearly still relatively small from a group perspective, but growing fast, and I suppose probably quite a lot of potential there.
Yeah, so they were kind of structurally in our organization when we took over Amatil, they were kind of hidden underneath the Australian-New Zealand structure. And then we carved them out into a separate kind of operating unit because they're very different. I mean, they're very different to New Zealand and Australia. And, you know, since we did that and we got Steve who runs that group, we've just been able to focus on what those markets need. And again, if you look at Fiji or Papua New Guinea, you know, we've great share. So across all categories. So we've a very strong market position, a legacy route to market and customer relationships that when you're there, you really feel how close the business is to the local market, and great pricing. So that leads to profitability and margin and good outlook in terms of GDP growth and demographics. So it's becoming a much bigger part of our business. It generates a lot of free cash flow. It doesn't tie up a lot of capital because pretty much we had assets in place. And by kind of carving it out and kind of shining it, you know, a light on it, we've been able to, particularly with the Coke company, you know, bring more relevant consumer propositions. So, you know, it's getting much bigger, which is great. And it's probably the best job in the group. So you're managing Fiji, Samoa, not bad locations, to be honest. Port Moresby is a bit different, but you can't have everything.
I suppose we touched on it there. You know, the last couple of years have been quite busy in terms of, you know, portfolio trimming and reorganizing the business as is post the acquisitions. But I think you recently mentioned on the Q1 call that, you know, much of the trimming of the portfolio is probably now done. And actually, if anything, going forward, you know, with Beam Suntory, you know, ending in Australia and New Zealand, probably you're looking perhaps more to add than to trim. Yeah. How do you think about kind of M&A outlook looking forward? Is it going to be more kind of small bolt-on style, you know, acquisitions? Or is there anything big out there that you've got your eye on?
So maybe on portfolio, so I think we've created some good space by exiting categories like bulk water in Australia and Europe, focusing on small water where we can make money. So I think from a category trimming, we're in great shape. I think within the categories, that's allowing us to kind of create space for innovation like the 850 in Germany. And then when you kind of step back, particularly on ARTD, we're adding a lot. So Bacardi and Coke, Absolut and Sprite, Jack Daniels and Coke, which is doing really well, particularly in GB. And we've, you know, together with the Coke company, we've bought a brand in Australia called Bilsons, which was a small, kind of more craft ARTD. But we felt with the transition out of Beam Suntory, it would help us kind of replace that business. Obviously not in 1 year, we got to grow into that. So in ARTD, we're definitely going to move to kind of, I think, having 5 or 6 really strong brand platforms. And we're, you know, and that'll be in Europe and in Australia Pacific. From a geographical M&A perspective, you know, we're certainly always curious to look, is there something that would create value for our shareholders? I think we've been quite choiceful about that and acquire businesses that are doing that. In the near term, it's kind of hard when you look around. I think most bottlers are quite happy. I mean, you know, there's always challenges, but I think if you look at the bottling businesses, it's returns, it's value, it's been transformational. So there's not a lot for sale. From a balance sheet perspective, you know, our net debt is down in a range that we're comfortable with, you know, that 2.5 to 3 around the midpoint. And that's about a year earlier than we planned. So that's great. So we have got optionality on capital allocation. Absent M&A, that will be true returns. So we're in the middle of our $1 billion buyback. But that still gives us the firepower to go after the right assets. So, you know, ultimately with the Coke company, you know, performance is the key to unlocking more territory. So that's all we can focus on, which is, you know, delivering our numbers, working closely with them. That's our priority. And then if something comes up, let's see. But it's you know, well, you know, the world doesn't change. The geographies are there. People, you can look at a map. There's probably not too much in the near term, I don't think. But that's okay.
Yeah. You commented there on the relationship with the Coke company, which is, you know, clearly a very important element of certainly the work you've done over the last few years, very important in terms of M&A, but also in terms of kind of global marketing campaigns and work with them. How would you, you know, you've been working in the Coke system for many years, and how would you characterize the nature of the relationship today versus 5 years ago, 10 years ago? Because, you know, from our perspective, it looks like it's pretty good.
Yeah, it's definitely in a very different place to 10 years ago. I think the biggest change has been, obviously, the company being very clever about, you know, consolidating bottlers into, you know, I would say good size entities like us. So good balance sheet power, good scale. So you get productivity, you get impact. I think that's been a really clever move from kind of that very fragmented individual country bottlers. That's pretty much gone now. So they've been very choiceful about how they do that and who they do that with. We've benefited from that, so very happy. I think fundamentally it comes down to economics. Clearly, leadership and personalities play a role, but economics generally is a key driver of behavior. And I think when the company moved their kind of financial model to the instance model, so, you know, way back it used to be a volumetric model where, you know, they just sold concentrate to the bottlers and we paid a price and that was it. And that gave them very little influence or role in pack pricing or NSR or mix. And if you look at value creation for a bottler, that's where it sits, right? So I think when they tied their revenue stream to the bottler's revenue stream on a kind of case revenue, I just saw a complete change. In terms of the conversations, investment choices, innovation, and that continues today. I think that's the fundamental alignment against the consumer and against what the consumer is prepared to pay, either at a premium level, because there's still consumers who want premiumization, they've not gone away, or at a very affordable level or in the middle. And I think that's really what is making a difference.
Brilliant. We've got a couple of minutes left, but so I suppose maybe one or two last questions. But one thing we haven't really discussed, I suppose, is Europe nearer term. We're coming off the back of two relatively damp summers. Q2 in particular was damp 2 years in a row. So far, at least in London, the weather seems to be relatively good. How are you thinking so far about the summer from here? Clearly, we're kind of, you know, some way into Q2 already, but what do you think about the activations for Q3? And I suppose, you know, this summer being a relatively important one for the European business.
Yeah, it's all to play for as we go into the summer. I think Q2 we definitely benefited from Easter. You know, so we talked a little bit to that. So, you know, April was very strong, but obviously that was an Easter benefit. May was in line with expectations. So is June. So I think we're well set up for a summer in terms of, you know, activation or campaigns and supply chain and customer relationships. We're in the right place. And you know, I think, as you said, the last two summers for those of us living in Europe haven't been fantastic. So we'll see. But I think all we're focused on is, you know, have we got the right pack price campaigns in place, particularly focused on away from home, because I think as we see consumer sentiment turning and maybe boosted by a normal summer, we expect people to be out more terrace activation. You know, so you'll see a lot more coolers in the market this summer than last year. That's been a big priority for us this year. You'll see activations in away from home, like Share a Coke is on our glass packaging as well. So it's not just retail. I'm hoping you'll see more branding as you walk around. So we're definitely, you know, set up for a really, really solid summer. And then we're also set up, obviously, for, you know, Q4, which is a big quarter for us as well. Yeah.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. I think that's all we've got time for. So I just want to say thanks again to Damien for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you to all of you. Thank you.